On now, everybody has to click the little okay, and I start reintroduce them. So welcome to Sunday night, There Is a Solution, newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Today is September the 4th, 2022. So visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. I'm now going to introduce our speaker, Don C., who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After he shares, there will be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what Don C. has shared. So please help me welcome Don C., a compulsive overeater from Connecticut. Welcome, Don. Take it away.
Thanks very much. Hi, everybody. My name is Don. As you see, I'm from Connecticut. I've been around OA for 40 years. I count my abstinence as 38 years, maintaining a little under 200-pound weight loss now for about 35 years. So OA saved my life and continues to save my life and give me a life. Jessica asked me to focus tonight not so much on history as on the recovery process, and that's what I'm going to do. I've been doing step work, step retreats, step studies, step everything for a lot of the years, because it's the steps that I worked and using the tools of the program that got me free. So I'm going to skip the first 41 years of what I was like tonight. If you want to find out my story, you can read it in the OA Third Edition, Overeaters Anonymous Third Edition. The name of the story in there is Freedom from Bondage. And you will, after I stop talking tonight, you'll understand what I meant by that title. Freedom is not free. Freedom is not free. So a physical, by the way, I'm about to be 82 years old. And so the words don't come out quite as quickly as they used to. And the thoughts don't go quite as quickly across there. So I have lots of notes and scripts and stuff here. So if it looks like sometimes I'm reading something, it's because I am reading something. But I just wrote this afternoon, so it's just me. I just want to get ahead of myself so I don't stutter and can't find a word. This way I've got the word down on the paper, hopefully. So a physical, emotional, and spiritual disease, which I have, requires a physical, emotional, and spiritual solution. Or in simpler terms, a new way of eating, a new way of thinking, and a new way of believing. Extraordinary problems require extraordinary solutions, somebody has said, and that's my experience. Changing attitudes, beliefs, ideas, values, and behaviors is not easy, but that's what this program has been about for me. The program gave me a process to make those changes through the 12 steps and 9 tools. Of course, when I came in, it was not 9 tools, it was 7 tools. We keep adding. There are some people that say, hey, we have 12 of everything else. We might as well have 12 tools. But I don't know if we're ever going to get the 12 tools. So the program showed me how to do this. If I'm willing to do the work, freedom comes. No magic, just actions and more actions. Thousands and thousands before me have proven that it works. But for whatever reason, not everyone is willing. Usually, in my experience, it just has to do with, have we hit a bottom yet? How much pain do we have? When I was at a bottom when I came in, suicidal. In my story, you'll see I was stood on a bridge over Hudson River in New York 30 days before I found my way into my first meeting. So I was at a low level. So I'm going to focus on my experience through the 12 steps and talk about the solution. Note that I said my experience, there's no one right way of working the steps, except to take them in order. That's about the only thing for sure. Take them in order because they're built on each other. all are ultimately, if you really look closely, are all about ego reduction. My point is, I'm not selling anything. Your process is up to you. While my first 10 years were strictly big book and AA 12 and 12, because that's what we have, the last 30 years, I've used both the big book and both 12 and 12. So the big book and 12 and 12, I use in my step retreats and step studies and step sponsoring, things from all of the books. The grandfather, of course, of all of it is the big book. So step one, let's see. Do we have some new newcomers here that don't know what the steps are exactly? Maybe I just should quickly say them. Step one is we admitted we were powerless over food, that our lives have become unmanageable. So step one, I put down the food. I had to detox from food so that I could objectively examine my life. Because since food really was the symptom, not the ultimate problem, I accepted that I had an incurable disease, but it was arrestable. And this disease, it was a disease over which willpower was useless. And I could never treat food like a normal eater, ever, ever. I was blessed by beginning to understand that pretty early on. I argued for, of course, at first, a lot of argument. I said, this is absurd. This is ridiculous. How could anyone be addicted to food? That's the craziest thing I've ever heard. And I said, you're telling me that I'm addicted to food, that I can't control this myself, that I am, you know, look at all my education, look at all my accomplishments in the corporate world, look at all this stuff I've done. And you're trying to tell me that I'm powerless? And this nice man, tough love guy, said, how much do you weigh again? And I said, well, I'm not at my top weight now. My top weight was close to 400. And he said, why? I said, why? He said, yeah, why were you 400? Did you want to be 400? And I said, not really. And he said, why did you get to 400? I said, well, I don't know. He said, did you eat too much? I said, no, I never eat too much. And he laughed hysterically and said, well, are you sure about that? How is it that you gain weight, Don? And so I said, well, it's not that I overeat. It's just that I eat all the time. I basically eat from the time I wake up in the morning until I go to bed at night. And he says, oh, okay. He said, did you like being 400 pounds? Did you have any problems with that? And I said, of course, I had all kinds of problems with that. He said, well, why didn't you stop eating, Ben, and lose weight? And I said, oh, I have stopped many times and lost weight. He said, why did you gain it back? And I said, I don't really know. He said, did you want to gain it back? Well, not really. He said, do you mean to tell me, Don, that you, with all of your accomplishments, all of your stuff, cannot control what you put into your mouth? And I, of course, wanted to punch him in the mouth, but I didn't. And I got the point. That's what powerless means. I wanted to and couldn't stop. Or if I did stop, I couldn't stop starting again. And that was the beginning of my understanding of the disease. Ultimately, I came to understand the reality of the addiction cycle talked about in the doctor's opinion, you know, with the mental obsession and the physical compulsion. And I come to accept that my brain was, in fact, different than the normal eaters. And I would always be physiologically different. In Silkworth's time, of course, the doctor that wrote the doctor's opinion, it was all conjecture. Now the science exists. It's clear that certain foods for me, sugars and refined carbs, activate the dopamine pathway in my brain. This is the same brain area activated by alcohol, cocaine, nicotine, and amphetamines. It's the pleasure center. One bite or one drink and an irresistible urge for more kicks in. Therefore, the solution is simple. Then just don't eat any of those poison foods. Fine. Now, where do I get the power to not eat those poison foods that I recognize as my drugs? That's what the rest of the steps are all about. So this leads to accepting that the food, in fact, is not the real problem, because if I don't pick up the first bite, the physiological compulsion does not begin. So food is the symptom. So how do I stop the obsession that leads to the first bite, that leads to the physiological compulsion? More specifically, how do I change the thinking that leads to the feelings that lead to the food obsession, that lead to the first bite, that leads to the out of control behavior? That's what the steps and the nine tools are all about. But here in the beginning, of course, the first thing I had to do was to identify the problem foods and then detox from those in order to clear my brain so that I could get started on the personality change and the healing process of the 12 steps, because that's what they're about. They're a process for change. As Appendix 2 states, defines spiritual awakening as personality change. If that Appendix 2 were not in the big book, I would not be here today. So I not only had to abstain from my trigger foods, I found out, but I also had to put structure into my eating. You know, normal eaters decide when and where to eat as they go along. I can't do that. I can't trust my brain. I'm an addict. So my plan framework became, early on, 3 meals a day, planned, weighed and measured, no sugar or refined carbs. Believe it or not, it's 40 years later and I do the exact same plan now. I follow the exact same plan now that I did 40 years ago. Step 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. From seeing and hearing recovery in the OA rooms, I gained the hope that kept me coming back to meetings. I was an atheist. I didn't care for the God idea at all. As a matter of fact, I was angry with the God idea that was being alluded to in that second step. You know, a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sane eating, it said. But in retrospect, I can see the hope that powered me forward, that kept me going forward, was in fact the recovery in the rooms. The program and the people in recovery were a power greater than myself, though I didn't really know that in the beginning. I had no idea, but that's what pulled me forward, the hope that I had because of seeing these people that I didn't understand. I didn't understand what they were doing. But over and over, I was told, you don't need to understand, just trust the process and just keep going and follow the directions, dummy. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. Well, step three for me took about 5 minutes, because all I did was commit to work in the program. Commit to work in the program. In other words, taking the rest of the 12 steps. So surrender for me in the third step wasn't giving up or giving everything to God. It was deciding to cooperate. To cooperate with a whole new set of ideas that were not mine. I admitted myself to the metaphorical OA hospital and said, okay, what do? I'll do whatever you guys tell me to do. I was told to work the rest of the steps and trust the process. I didn't need to understand it, just trust it and take the actions in the steps and use all the tools. So now I'm going to talk about 4, 5, 6, and 7 sort of together. 4, for those of you who are new, is made a moral inventory of myself. 5 is admitted to God, to another person, and to myself the exact nature of my wrongs, which is about telling them all about my 4th. What did I uncover in my 4th? 6 and 7 are about we're entirely willing to change and willing to change. And 7 was ask God to change me in that. So these are the heavy duty change steps. This is where my recovery really began. 1, 2, and 3 were just about the foundation of the house. You know, now I'm begin building the walls of the house. They were about getting me ready to make the changes. I was sober, abstinent, clear mind, and I was ready to dig in and take an honest look at myself. In these change steps, I began rebuilding myself, as I said. Major personality change. I identified the dysfunctional thinking. You could call it dysfunctional thinking, shortcomings, defects, counterproductive, whatever you want. It's things that didn't suit me well, that didn't serve me well. I began uncovering those in step four, the things that led me to begin using food as a drug for comfort or escape, because that's what I was doing, didn't even realize it, and then I got addicted to it. So this was all subconscious in the early stages of my disease. I had no idea what I was doing. While I was slightly overweight in my childhood, it was not a big problem for me. I was an athlete, numbering in a number of sports. And so if you saw a picture of my high school picture, it would look like this perfect specimen of a man. My real problem started in my late teens and early 20s when life got really hard. That's when I started to do this. In step five, in talking with a person experienced in recovery, I basically validated the stuff that I had written down in step four. His first concern was to make sure that I had taken my inventory and not all those other people who I blamed for my problems inventory, right? Like my spouse, like my mother and father, like my kids, like my boss, etc. I took my inventory, not their inventory. I came out of step five with basically three lists. One was my strong points, assets. In the early days, we always did asset lists, assets and liabilities, assets and liabilities. So I had an asset list when I came out of there. Second thing I had was a list of all the shortcomings. My sponsor in the fifth step had helped me put together a summary. These are the key things that need to be worked on, Don. These are your highest priorities. These are the things you're going to work on in six and seven. So that was the third thing I had when I came out of my fifth step was a tentative list of people that I might need to make amends to later in step nine. Because as I had gone through my life in step four, naturally that came up. So six and seven were simply, for me, identifying with lots of help from sponsors, the antidotes to all the shortcomings. In other words, the solution. Think problem, think solution. This is what I do. This is the problem. What's the opposite of that? What's the antidote for this? Instead of blaming everybody, how about growing up and being accountable for myself, for example? That's the stuff I had to look at. Left column, right column, assets, a problem, solution, problem, solution, problem, solution. So that's what I was looking for. New ways of thinking and dealing with life. A new me. I helped my sponsor and I and others helped work on defining what this new me would look like. What were the new things that I had to work toward? Then my job, once I basically put this action plan down on paper, was to start trying to live in those solutions. Yeah, I was asking a higher power to help give me the courage to do this. But ultimately, it was me that had to work on the change. What I learned was that with higher power's help, I act my way into right thinking, not think my way into right acting. That might be the most important sentence that I say here tonight that I've learned in this program, is that there is no magic. There is no tap on the head and make me free. I have to act my way into right thinking, not think my way into right acting. No magic wand. I have to take the action. Let me give you several examples of the personality transformation that I mentioned in Appendix 2 of the big book that began for me here in 4, 5, 6, and 7. And as I go through these examples, you will see if you will be able to see the shortcomings or the defects that I had identified in steps 4 and 5. So one, I face and deal with life today rather than blaming and eating. Blaming and eating. Blame everybody. Wine, wine, wine. Go eat. I take responsibility today. I came in at 41 and that tough love sponsor of mine said, Don, it's time to grow up. It's time to grow up. You're no longer 15. You can't blame all those people anymore. It's time for you to do it. No more blaming others or circumstances. No more self-pity. No more victim. No more envy or jealousy. I do a gratitude list every morning. I have for forever and ever, every day, to help keep me in the right frame of mind for the day. I moved from hopelessness. I was suicidal when I came in, as I said. I moved from hopelessness to hope, and from a reactive life to a proactive life. In other words, not just sitting back and waiting and reacting to whatever happened, but deciding what it is that I wanted to happen or want to work on. What are my projects? What are my solutions? What are the things I want to do? And move toward those. Proactive rather than reactive. A second point, I've moved from thinking that self-sufficiency is man's highest goal to being willing to ask for help, to accepting that I, in fact, need help, that no man is an island. From my father, I got, don't ever ask for help. Real men don't ask for help. Men don't show their feelings and they don't ask for help. You got to be self-sufficient. You ask for help and somebody gives you help, then you're going to owe them. And you don't want to owe anybody. But that's the kind of culture that I grew up. And of course, that is total nonsense. Not true. We need each other. A third point, I work hard on staying out of self-centeredness and controlling. I've stopped that mental master planning for the world that I used to do. You know, I'm imposing shoulds and oughts on people and situations. They should do this. They should do this. This is the way that ought to go. You know, and I worked from the president right on down. This thinking set me up to always being frustrated because the people in the situations didn't go the way I thought they should go. In other words, my way. You know, the problem was they couldn't read my mind. You know, I don't understand why these people can't read my mind and know what it is that they're supposed to do. But they couldn't read my mind. And if anybody could read my mind as to what they're supposed to do, they wouldn't have done it anyway. They're defiant, you know, we're naturally defiant. Fourth point, I let go of selfishness. There's been a gradual paradigm shift from how do I get what I want to how can I be useful? How can I be useful? That's what I base my life on today. The 11-step prayer, of course, admonishes me to seek to comfort, understand, and love rather than to be comforted, be understood, and be loved. The fifth point, I work hard on flexibility. Rigidity was actually number one, believe it or not, on my first fourth step in 1982. Rigid, not going to change, not going to change. This is the way it is, blah, blah, blah. No, I can't do that. I need flexibility. So today I practice what I call structured flexibility. Yes, I have a plan. Every morning I do a food plan, an activity plan for the day, and an attitude plan. But it's flexible. If I have to change something, okay, I have to change something, but it's just there. Six, I've moved from anger and resentment into acceptance of the world as it is and people as they are. I moved away from hatred and animosity into forgiveness, from intolerance to tolerance. Intolerance was a big, big deal for me. Not so much bias as intolerance of others who I thought were less than or stupid or all kinds of things, just not tolerant. Live and let live, of course, is one of our slogans and a big part of my life today. It's one of my top five, live and let live. Seven, I let go of the self-sabotaging perfectionism that ensured that I was always feel not good enough. You know, perfectionism is one of the offshoots of fear. Fear has a lot of things that derive from fear. Perfectionism is one of them because I'm so afraid that I'm going to fail or I'm going to look stupid or not be good enough. I overdo everything. And that's how I became a compulsive worker. In addition to my compulsive overeating, I worked 12 or 15 hours a day for many years because of this. I was afraid of not being good enough. So I had to let go of that. I did let go of that. And say, you know, I'll do my best. And that's good enough. I've moved from point eight. I've moved from unfeeling numbness to feeling again. When I came to the program, I was totally numb. I had a wall around me that started to go up when I was about 20, I guess the wall started to go up. I was hurt very, very deeply by a woman, naturally. And I said, never again, never again will I ever open my heart to anything like this. And it all went up. And through my 20s and 30s, despite getting married, despite having kids, all that, I really couldn't feel. I really didn't feel deep inside of me. All I felt was numbness and just keeping you away. That wall was there to protect myself from being vulnerable. That wall began to come down in step five when I told another human being, for the first time in my whole life, the truth about myself, who I was, and what my things were. So that came down, and I was able to actually feel love again. It was amazing. It came pretty fast after the fifth step. Even harder, I was able to accept love. You know, for me, it was much harder to accept love than it was to give love. A ninth example, I've moved from feeling inadequate and unworthy and not enough to feeling I'm okay. I'm valuable. I have something to give. I'm useful, especially to other suffering compulsive overeaters. I am enough. I have enough. I do enough is one of my affirmations. Another one, I put discipline and structure into my life, starting with the eating, but extending to everything. I moved away from pretense. All my life, pre-program was play acting. All my life, I was on stage, always a phony, always seeking strokes from you because my value, according to my mother, was dependent upon what you thought of me. So I had to do everything that I knew to be able to get you to like me and say, oh, great, Don, blah, blah, blah. Otherwise, I was useless. And so that made me not authentic. It made me on stage, as I said, all the time. And here I took that wall down. I began to be authentic. I began to be who I am. Two more points. I've moved from cynicism. I was very cynical. I've moved from that into seeing people as basically good rather than basically bad. Again, back to my mother who said, remember, people are out to get you. Don't ever trust anybody. You can't, and no matter what they're doing, they're out to come over you in some way to get something for you. So don't trust anybody. Always expect the worst, she said, and then never be disappointed when you expect the worst. I know those things sound crazy to some of you, but that is truly the culture that I came out of. Last point, I said I came in as an atheist. It's been a very, very long spiritual journey through the years, but I would say I'm not exactly an atheist anymore. So I've moved from that into finally making a connection deep within, as the big book says, with a quiet voice within. So I'm no longer paralyzed by the fear that I had before. Of course, you know, I was taught early on, courage is not necessarily the absence of fear, it's doing it anyway. And that's what I had to do a lot of in the beginning of the program. I've said, I'm afraid to do that. I'm afraid to talk to her. And my sponsor says, in his words, I don't give a shit if you're afraid, do it anyway. And so, okay, so I would go and do it anyway. Steps 8 and 9, I took full responsibility. 8 and 9 are about became willing to make amends to the people that I'd harmed and make amends in step 9. That includes forgiveness of people, by the way, for things that they have done to me, as well as self-forgiveness for me. So I took full responsibility in 8 and 9 for what I had done. I made amends. I put the past away. That sounds easy, not so easy, but I was able to put the past away. There was a lot of past stuff that needed to be put away. I only had about a dozen amends to make my first time through the steps in 1982 and 83. Most were living amends to my spouse, to my kids, to my mother and father, and my employer. All those things I've talked a little bit about in 4, 5, 6, and 7, those were the things that are at the heart of my new behaviors with my spouse, with my kids, with my boss. My two kids were both in their teens at the time of the amends. I sat down with each of them individually and talked to them. Lots of tears all around. They were a little skeptical. They had heard their dad make promises before, and they said, okay. But I told them what it was I was going to do. Amends means to change behaviors. I told them exactly, this is the dad I want to become. This is what I'm going to do with you. I'm going to go to this, do this, do this. And then guess what? I did it. I made my commitments and I followed them. And so right here in the ninth step with my kids in their teens, it was a major transition for a parent reconnecting with children. Changed our lives at that point. I know I was successful because today they trust me with the grandkids, right? I'm definitely a better grandfather than I was a father. There's no question about that. I was a very cash register, honest person, so I really didn't have any of those kinds of amends. The amends to my employer were about what they called theft of time. I did a lot of traveling in my last 10 years or so in the job, countries all over the world. And I was not always in exactly the place where people thought I was. So, you know, like, oh, wouldn't hurt to me for me to go over there and spend half a day at that resort or whatever, you know, that kind of stuff. So after steps 8 and 9, what I had, and it's just gotten bigger and bigger over the years, is a new day, a new life, a gift, right? In the big book, the promises come at this point. No, they're not all perfect. Some are not always there, and sometimes they will go away and they'll come back. But a lot of the promises really started happening. The healing came. These steps are a healing process. They're a change process and a healing process. The obsession for the food was lifted. I no longer thought of food when I felt frustrated or anxious or sad. So today I hold on to the gift by actively living in steps 10, 11, and 12. Let me give you a little bit on those and close for the day. Step 10, every morning I inventory my emotional and spiritual condition and make the necessary corrections to my thinking or behavior. I continue to work as well as keep continue to grow as well as keep the slate clean as I go. No need to accumulate guilt about bad behavior or harm to others. Notice I said I do an inventory in the morning, not in the evening, as the big book talks about. That works best for me. For several years, I did it in the evening, plus ongoing inventory, of course, all day. But I just seem to be too tired at night to really do it well. And so I started doing it in the morning, and now I've been doing it for years and years in the morning. I do a brief inventory every morning, but every couple of weeks, being a compulsive person, I do an extensive inventory. I look at about 30 traits and I ask myself, how am I doing on these? And I rate myself with 3 answers, usually, sometimes, or not much. So, for example, how am I doing living in accountability rather than blaming? That's the actual question. And so 99% of the time I check off, usually. Notice the avoidance of perfectionism. I didn't say always. There is no always. There is no 100%. But I can say usually or more often than not, I do. Another question, how am I doing living in faith rather than fear? And that one often gets a sometimes rating. It's driven by my unfixable chronic pain and disability that I have now in my life. Another question, how am I doing living in hope rather than despair? And that one, once again, driven by my unfixable chronic pain and disability problem, often gets a not much rating. I'm not doing this well as I should. So the point of all this is to keep my weak points in focus so I can work on them, so I can pray to strengthen my faith.
I'm done.
Thank you. In my 7-step prayer, for example, I always say 7th in the morning, and I add a sentence at the end that says, you said 5 minutes, right?
We're at time now.
Oh, let me just finish quickly. 3 more minutes. I always say at the end of the 7-step prayer, I say specifically, God, please help me live in faith rather than fear and anxiety. Help me accept the reality of my age and physical condition. Step 11, a very structured approach every day. Opening prayer, write down my food plan, work plan, and attitude plan for the day. Do the inventory I just mentioned. Read some daily reading books, at a minimum, the two OA books. Write down how each applies to me. Do a gratitude list. Say the Serenity, 3rd, 7th, and 11th step prayers. Quickly run through what I call my articles of faith, which we don't have time to talk about tonight. I then close with some affirmations. I found out a long time ago that I can change how I feel by changing the sentences going through my head. And that's what affirmations do for me. I'm a big fan of affirmations. I was handed the Just for Today affirmation card in my first year of program, 1982. And I'm still saying those affirmations. So let me just wrap up by saying step 12, you know, it's three parts: spiritual awakening, carrying the message, and practicing these principles. Carrying the message, I learned early on that I had to do service and try to pass on this message of recovery, or I would never hold on to it myself. Service isn't optional, it's the 12 steps. Not only will we relapse if we don't, but OA will die if we don't carry the message to the still suffering. So I've always done service, but since my retirement in 97, after 30 years in the business world, OA has become my vocation. So that's what I do basically full time. I try to carry the message to the still suffering compulsive overeaters and live according to what Dr. Bob said in his closing days, love and service in all of the manifestations of those two words. So that's a little or a lot about this transformation process as I have lived it. To those of you who are still in the early stages, you don't have to understand it. Just trust the damn process and just keep going, keep plowing, and things happen. You'll look back and say, I don't know what happened, but something happened. I feel so much better now. Thank you for asking me to speak.
Thank you so much, Don. I'm going to stop the recording now.